Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
Athens was chosen as the site for the capital of modern Greece. In that city, Renaissance, which was related to the very fervent ideas of neoclassicism. From the very beginning, the architects of the new Athens looked forward to the coexistence of the ancient and the modern city. They have delimited the areas for the archaeological excavations, and they have proposed an architectural landscaping around the hill of the Acropolis. The conflicts of real life have not always permitted the realization of their dreams, yet the dreams have always been a challenge for the collective imagination, and sometimes they have been turned into reality. The latest projects for the reunification of the archaeological sites and the implementation of the new Acropolis Museum can be criticized, but are still going far and provide good examples of the contemporary making of the historical and architectural heritage of Athens. For a better understanding of and a closer look at the aesthetics of historical stratification, I will follow up this coexistence of the old and the new from the 1830s to our times, focusing on some projects and realizations which are bringing to light the will to preserve and, above all, to design the historical past of the modern city. Without doubt, the origins of the actual state of the archaeological sites of Athens have to be linked with Otto, the first king of Greece and the son of the venerated King Ludwig of Bavaria, who opted for the selection of ancient Athens as the site of his modern capital. As an aftermath, there was sure to be a complex and multi-layered superimposition of the old and the new. Under the plan prepared in 1832 by two young Berlin-trained architects, Stamatis Kleanthis and Eduard Schaubert, the terrain of the ancient city would first have to be cleared of any modern construction so that archaeological excavations could take place. The most important of the issues with which we shall be concerned below had already been brought up in this plan. The new city would encompass the free space of the archaeological zone, which had been covered by modern but simple constructions and then spread out in a northerly direction. The distinction was clearly shown on the plan with a demarcation line, but what is of particular interest is the argument advanced by the two architects. This area contains priceless art treasures and significant historical inscriptions, yet even if the archaeological finds were not so important, it would still be worthwhile to free the area of the existing ancient monuments, of accumulations of soil, unsightly hovels and modern houses, which are a source of regret and irritation to visitors who have come to admire the ancient art, just as they prevent artists and intellectuals from reproducing those monuments in the fullness of their beauty. In the area of the monuments, excavations ought to take place down to the ground level of the ancient city so as to lay bare the ancient road system with its streets and squares. Here and there, a quaint little church in a ruined state of the Byzantine Middle Ages might be left as an elegant contrast to the works of the ancients. The area among the monuments could be laid out as a garden, with trees and lawns, with the best sites being selected as points from which the antiquities may be viewed, thus making the whole area into a museum of ancient art second to none in the world. This first description of the archaeological site of Athens is notable for its disposition towards purism, focusing on the preservation of the ruins only of ancient Greece, and for its inclination towards the picturesque in the landscaping of the garden and the preservation of Byzantine churches. This was the dominant trend in dealing with ancient monuments in the period of neoclassicism, which was still to the forefront throughout Europe and received the seal of approval of no less a personage than Leo von Klenze, the official architect of the King of Bavaria, who came to Athens in 1834 with instructions to correct the initial plan. Klenze accepted the definition and character of the archaeological zone, adding paths for walking around the garden and proposing that Turkish mosques be preserved side by side with the Byzantine churches to reinforce historical memory and propound the picturesque. On his suggestion too, the fortified Acropolis became a protected archaeological site, making the first step towards that declaration of monuments which compose nowadays the heritage of ancient Athens. It is true that Cleanthes and Schaubert had made no proposals for the fortification of the upper city. Klenze intervened to say that the revelation of the ancient monuments and of the ancient terrain here is more desirable than in the lower city, and that the Acropolis should be liberated as soon as possible from the ruined and bad quality buildings of barbarous times, so that the restoration of the monument could begin. A small museum could be constructed, and the rest of the site planted with clumps of palm trees, cypresses, and olives, so that the whole would become an important and picturesque landmark in Attica. The work, which began the same year, cleared the sacred hill of any construction which was not classical and served as the beginning of the conservation works. In a symbolic restoration of the Parthenon, on September 10, 1834, Leo von Klenze addressed the king in these words: "The traces of a barbarous age, ruins and amorphous rubble will be eliminated here, as they will be everywhere else in Greece, and the remains of the glorious past will be resurrected with fresh radiance as the firmest foundations for a glorious present and future." We term this approach the archaeological trend, because its objective was first and foremost to discover, preserve, or utilize the antiquities in the center of the modern city, developing itself out of the limits of the archaeological site. At the same period, there was another trend, expressed by Karl Friedrich Schinkel and Alexander Ferdinand von Quast, which aimed to preserve the ancient monuments in quite a different sense. In 1834, Schinkel, same year, Schinkel conceived an ambitious plan for the construction of the royal palace on the Acropolis. He in no way scorned the masterpieces that stood on the sacred rock. On the contrary, he admired them from the bottom of his heart, even if he hadn't visited them. His belief was rather that they would be better preserved if they could be reactivated amid modern buildings of the best sort, which furthermore would be modeled on them. this was none other than an expression of the theory of imitation mimesis, which had been formulated by Catremer de Quincy in a quest for continuity and rivalry between the new and the old. This reciprocal enhancement was reflected in the proposed interweaving of the ancient and the modern, the morphological and typological rules for which were to be drawn from the form and arrangement of the restored classical buildings. All the other structures on the Acropolis were to be removed, as indeed was done on the prompting of Clancy. The palace itself was designed on a rectangular grid to the east of the Parthenon around large atria with porticos. Its grandiose, multicolored rooms, which were decorated with griffins, leopards, and golden lions, the rotunda of the panorama on the east, and the stadium hippodrome between the Erechtheum and the Parthenon were designed in a manifestly Roman style with a quantity of brush strokes from Pompeii, reminiscent of the descriptions of Pliny's villa. The classical times of the architect from Prussia, who knew Greece from books and engravings, were an eclectic florilegium in which the various periods of the ancient world met without any fear of historical stratification. In the same year, von Quast published in Germany a brochure in which he celebrated Schinkel's design and proposed the building of the new Athens on the hills which surround the Acropolis and on the land which previously had been destined for accommodation of the archaeological park. Quast, for his part, found Schinkel's plan praiseworthy and supplemented it by proposing that the new city of Athens be built on the hills of the Acropolis. To his mind, the coexistence of the most important surviving monuments of antiquity and of the contemporary building, which would compete with them, would contribute to the enhancement and reciprocal invigoration of both forms of architecture. Quast was thus opposed to the marking out of a clearly defined area for excavations, which would produce only the material necessary for the composition of academic theses, piles of ruins, and the foundations of buildings of secondary importance, in other words, a dead city incapable, as Quast put it, of educating the soul of the people. He, who was to be appointed the first Staatskonservator of Prussia, thus proposed that the royal palace be constructed on the Acropolis and the Cathedral Church of Christ the Savior on the Areopagus Hill, a huge arched bridge would connect the church with the propylaea on the Acropolis, lined with the major public buildings of the new kingdom. This we can call the architectural trend, since its overriding concern was the continuity of ancient and modern in architecture as in life itself. In other words, there were to be no borders or dividing lines between the new and the ancient buildings. The age-long endurance of classical ideas would vindicate this grafting, and the spirit of rivalry with the ancient, translated in terms of modern architecture, would vindicate the architect and grafter. Fortunately, unfortunately, the architectural trend had no luck on the Acropolis and the lower city. The difficulties in which the new state became embroiled prevented much action being taken. Indeed, The persistence of the problems dictated the submission of constantly revised proposals and ambitious plans. This is precisely what happened with what was called the archaeological section of the town, the part of which to the northwest of the Acropolis was very soon occupied by the little houses of the poor. At the heart of the whole series of proposals lay the demolition of these houses, the conducting of archaeological excavations, and the laying out of a spacious archaeological park, which would be a kind of open-air museum. The most important of these to be put forward in the 19th century were those of Lysandros Kaftatsoglou in 1839 and 1858, of a committee of architects and engineers on which the Frenchman François Boulanger served in 1860, and by the parliamentarian Aristides Balanos in 1866. The architect Kaftatsoglou had studied in Rome and was well acquainted with the problems of modern coexistence with the remains of the ancient world. In 1839, he presented in French the sketch of a plan for the city of Athens with the view to replacing the plan being implemented, which is ill-conceived and will never achieve full implementation. His arguments, which he reiterated in his proposal of 1858, had to do chiefly with the necessity for excavation in the archaeological section of the city, which had to be protected by every means from the erection of new buildings. Even the famous painter Ingres is said to have supported his views and personally to have told him that the Greeks greatly neglect the conservation of the ancient monuments. Your fellow countrymen, the painter said, should know that these sacred relics do not belong only to you Greeks, but to the whole of the cultivated world. So make haste to liberate the ancient city of Athens, that sacred land, from private houses, which bear witness to your indifference and your neglect, and take care to locate the new city as far as possible from the ancient. These recommendations and the sketch of a plan which turned the city to the east were the main contribution of Kaftatsoglou, who had focused his attention on the immediate need for excavations. But he didn't speak at all about the landscaping of the sites which would be liberated by these excavations, although we can suppose that the Forum Romanum would have been his obvious example. We encounter more or less the same things in the other proposals of the 19th century, which competed with one another in eloquence without becoming particularly specific. The 20th century was to see even more proposals. The city plans of 1908, 1914, 1919, 1924, and 1929 all dealt with this issue, that of 1924, which was drawn up with the help of the French town planner Ernest Ebrard, and was more ambitious, devoted the whole of its first section to it. In this section, we can read the first detailed historical narrative to the landscaping of the archaeological sites of Athens, together with specific proposals. The new city should be clearly separated from the ancient. Excavations should be carried out and selected and restored examples of architecture from all periods, including some of the poor neoclassical houses of the 19th century, should be retained in order to produce the biggest park in Athens, which would contribute to the everyday education and recreation of the residence, thanks to the embellished antiquities which would have been rendered accessible. This was, without a doubt, the proposal of an urban planner who was interested in the way of life in a modern environment which was pleasant and rich in memories from all periods. Moreover, this was the first time that an art and history value was recognized in the constructions of the modern city, neglected in the proposal, reflected in the proposal to retain a very few examples from the great mass of buildings which had to be demolished. In 1946, as soon as World War II was over, Kostas Biris, director of architecture of the municipality of Athens, put forward a building plan in which was included a large archaeological park in the center of the city. This park began to the east of the environs on the environs of the Ilissos River, and the stadium embraced the hill and the archaeological sites situated around the Acropolis, together with the Agora and the Keramikos, turned westwards, following the Sacred Way, to include the Academy and extended, even if this remained a matter of words only, as far as the Sanctuary of Eleusis. This vast park, which was bounded in the city center by the ancient wall, was to constitute a world cultural center, to the archaeological discoveries of which sports facilities were to be added, together with a large stadium, a large open-air theater, museums, the international schools of archaeology, international universities, and cultural functions of every kind. The archaeological trend, which lay at the outset of this urban planning vision, finally yielded to the architectural with which it clearly coexists. The unification of the archaeological sites of Athens, which is proposed, was an urban planning intervention of a broader cultural character. The broad scope of this idea, which was greatly appreciated in its time but could not be realized, came to the forefront again in the 1960s, and particularly after 1979. In this latter period, the unification of the archaeological sites of Athens was also proposed by other architects to become, in the end, the peak of joint efforts for the Ministry of Culture, the Ministry of Public Works, and the Municipality of Athens. The life of the capital now seemed to depend upon it. I will return later to the matter of this unification project. In the meantime, I will give some account of two smaller interventions which, unlike the many ambitious and usually unfeasible plans, were accomplished with exceptional success in the mid-20th century in constructing a part of the archaeological park which potentially started out in 1832. They are contrasting in nature, but the combination of them definitely changed the situation in the area which surrounds the Acropolis. The first began in the 1930s. It involved excavations carried out in the archaeological section as that had been defined by the very first plan for Athens, after the demolition of a whole picturesque quarter with small houses. In fact, the excavations didn't extend beyond half the area which had originally been specified, since the Greek side was, again, unable to pay the cost of the expropriations. Plaka, the neighborhood which spreads to the northern slope of the Acropolis, is still in position. On the other hand, that which was located to the space between the stoa of Attalus and the Thysion was expropriated and excavated by the efforts of the American School of Classical Studies, thanks to the money of John Rockefeller, among others. The work which brought to light the site of the ancient agora lasted from 1931 to 1956, when the restoration of the Hellenistic stoa to serve as a museum was completed. This was a high-level operation which unearthed all the strata of the foundations and consequently the fabric of the successive coverings of the site on which one of the most important parts of the ancient city developed. In the interior of the Agora archaeological site, the trees are today luxuriant. The antiquities rise at least above ground level. The signposting is discreet, and the museum clearly Hellenistic. There are naturally belvederes, and a small Byzantine church, which has been restored. Of course, the two buildings selected have been rebuilt by modern means. The museum is a new reinforced concrete structure. Which was carefully finished in white marble. The Church of the Holy Apostles has been stripped of its additions over 1,000 years and has lost the sense of religious devotion which it had in the modern age, in order to take on the hypothetical form which it had at the days of its consecration. By the means of aesthetically sterilized archaeological intervention. I mean this. And the park is designed in its entirety by the help of American landscape architects to a scenario of guided tours for visitors which bring out chronologically at least a range of strata from the past. Nevertheless, the specifications of Cleanthes, Schaubert and Klenze seem eventually to have been realized. Walking around, one feels one is treading the same ground as the Athenians of the 4th century BC, that one is sitting on exactly the same stones, but at the same time, one feels lost in a dead city, a city in complete contrast with the busy streets nearby. One has the sense of being in an old dig which has been carefully preserved so as to serve as an archaeological park in the center of the modern city. It is impossible to cross the site without paying at the entrance, impossible to escape from the gaze of the custodian, and as soon as the gates close at night, the few hectares of the agora become a real black hole in the throbbing heart of the Greek capital. This is an example of what I have called the archaeological trend, the production of an enclosed and totally guarded space of an open-air museum whose exhibits are treated on the simple, clear terms of the best possible preservation. The second of the interventions was of much shorter duration. It lasted only 4 years, from 1955 to 1958. Its purpose was to landscape the Hill of the Muses and the approaches to the Acropolis in such a manner that they would become a promenade area of a character worth to its proximity to the monuments of the ancient city. The project was undertaken by the architect Dimitris Pikionis, who designed a park with stone-paved paths, sitting recesses, a little church, a cafe, and other utilitarian structures. Everything was done in an emotionally charged atmosphere of particular sensitivity towards the component parts of the Greek architecture of unbroken historical continuity over and above its actual history. Best, however, to let Picionis speak for himself. The architect will have to devise new methods to deal with every aspect of the work, down to the last detail. He will have to revise all building methods currently in use and invest them with the validity of practices inspired by ancient art. Hence, the construction of the way stations, pavilions, etc. will require stones of a special texture, shape and color, as well as large loose boulders and marble lintels from ancient or neoclassical buildings. Reliefs and capitals will be ensconced in the walls. The alleyways and pathways will be ornamented with antique fragments, such as stone benches and cylindrical shapes belonging to Hellenistic tombs, which can be found in abundance in the courtyard of the National Archaeological Museum. Several other antique fragments discovered in situ will be also used for this purpose. As regards the landscaping of the site, the existing number of shrubs will have to be increased, and a large amount of olive trees, both wild and cultivated, will have to be planted. The ancient monuments call for the kind of plants that customarily adorn sanctuaries in antiquity, pomegranate, laurel, and myrtle. In fact, the aim of the contemporary architecture of this park was to reactivate the ancient spirit in the use of shapes and fragments from ancient buildings in a kind of refined set design, which did not come to a halt when faced with real monuments, such as the simple post-Byzantine chapel of St. Demetrius Lombardiaris, but proceeded to skillfully revise and rectify what was old. Adding a narthex and a wooden open-sided porch and facing the outer walls of the nave with new and elaborate masonry. Picioni's eyes were fixed on the ancients, but he saw them through the experiences of the vernacular tradition. This mediation safeguarded the continuity between the contemporary and the old in the natural and cultivated manner of simple people, who fit fragments of pain and joy into the grand collage of the collective, ethnic, and simultaneously universal memory. For Picionis, writes Haralambos Bouras, a Greek historian who saw the hell of the Muses project at close quarters, tradition was the survival of the most ancient rhythms. It was a single and divisible, almost universal flow of shapes drawn from common root shapes which were like the words in a plastic language, shapes which went beyond the typology or morphology of a specific era. To make these words still more emphatic and wide-ranging, the British historian Kenneth Frampton noted that the pine wood framed temenos and pavilion adjacent to the reconstructed Lombardiaris church seemed as though they had been drawn from Japan over long eons of time through Asia and the cultural sieve of Byzantium. A careful look at the spaces themselves with an emphasis on the details will enable us to recognize in the materials and in the way they are fitted together, in the stone, the wood, the brick, and the cement, the true meaning of those words and the literal nature of the historical stratification of which I'm speaking. The decodification is not, of course, so much a matter of applying the faculty of reason, but of a Ruskinian reading of history and its reactivation for the ideological and other purposes of contemporary society. In other respects, this park, to which access is unrestricted, even at night, is a real and very lively attraction for people from all walks of life, especially on public holidays and in the summer months. It is a characteristic example of what I have called the architectural trend, the reciprocal invigoration of the ancient and the new, in a manner which knows how to touch our sad souls in the inhospitable environment of the modern city. I return now to the last mayor plan, which was announced by the Ministries of Culture and Public Works in 1995 under the rather modest title of Unification of the Archaeological Sites of Athens. Its basic lines revert to the guidelines formulated by Kostas Biris in 1946. The declared aim was the unification of the archaeological sites on which excavations had taken place and of those on which they were to take place in the future, in order that an archaeological park of a length of 4 kilometers, extending from the Panathenaic Stadium to the Academy and later to the Eleftheros Sanctuary, would take shape. However, the 700 hectares of this park greatly exceed the extent of the archaeological sites, including the greater part of the center of Athens, together with residential, office, and commerce neighborhoods. In fact, it is a plan for the reconstituting of the city which was designed in 1834, and even more so since linear interventions towards the north, south, and west were included. The scope of this plan, which in the first phase was to have been completed by 2000 and later by the time of the Olympic Games of 2004, included the conservation of hundreds of scheduled buildings of every period, the construction of museums, the reconstruction of large squares, and the creation of new ones, the conversion of large numbers of streets into pedestrian grounds, integrated urban equipment, and the planting of trees which would have been gone beyond any precedent. In a country which has grown accustomed to the announcement of plans incapable of realization, there was every reason to view this gigantic program with suspicion. And yet, it is a fact that 13 years later, a large part of the original intentions have been sometimes for better and sometimes for worse realized. More particularly as regards what is of interest to us, the streets which surround the archaeological site of the Agora and those which link it with the Keramikos, the Hill of the Muses and the Acropolis have been turned into pedestrian grounds. And this way, the fabric of the streets, which up to 2004 were thoroughfares of heavy and through vehicle traffic, intensifying the introspection of the archaeological sites of either side, became a linear promenade piazza for Athenians and tourists, on which the surrounding sites meet and are finally united. At the end of the route, moreover, the new Acropolis Museum has become a reality after 3 decades of unsuccessful efforts, thus creating yet another pool in the ideological recomposition of the ancient world. It is a well-known fact that this museum was built mainly to contribute to the reuniting of the marbles of the Acropolis, chiefly those of the Parthenon, which at the height of neoclassicism were taken to major European museums with the British museum as their principal destination. This endeavor is interesting, but the result is dubious and confirms the fact that issues which concern the history of a country and a people are, in the last analysis, political issues in the broader sense, which means that history is written and then always additionally manufactured in the modern era. As we have seen, the plans a project of the period under consideration can be classed as belonging to either the archaeological approach or the architectural approach. The first trend leads from Cleanthes, Schaubert, and Klenze to the work done by the American school. The second from Quast and Schinkel to the projects of Piccionis. Historical stratification is the objective of both approaches as they project the relationship of continuity between the old and the new with the help of ideological arguments which they both accept. But they express that stratification in different ways because the demand for it also comes within the realm of aesthetics. It is no accident that all the original proposals for the archaeological part resort to the argument of the picturesque, or to be more exact, of the painterly, in German, malerisch, treating the monument as isolated points of interest in an entirely modern landscaping of the space. The park of which Cleanthes, Schaubert, and Klenze dreamed would not have been out of place in any large European city, even 50 years prior to their plans. But in that case, the desired historical stratification would have been the outcome of the deliberate and, above all, aesthetic selection of the component parts, which would have been imported or specially constructed so as to form a kind of architectural zoo. In Athens, on the other hand, the buildings were already in place, and the question was more one of selecting which structures to demolish and which to accentuate so as to produce the optimal combination of the aesthetic and the ideological. The belvederes, the walks, the planting of the park with trees and lawns, these were all self-evident parameters in the aesthetic result being aimed for, and they were applied even to the arid ground of Athens. And of course, it was entirely natural for a German like Klenze to propose the retention on equal terms of Byzantine churches and Turkish mosques as picturesque and historical values, just as he would have been proposed almost any coexistence of monuments. It was equally natural for a Greek like Cleanthes to forget the mosques and any Turkish memory. The situation is a little different in the proposals of Schinkel and Quast. Selected old structures are preserved as isolated picturesque components, not this time of a park, but of the city of Athens itself and of the palace complex on the Acropolis. Continuity between the old and the new is global. There are no limits or distinctions in this universal entity of urban space. More or less, the same is true in the case of Piccionis. New stones, ancient stones, natural stones, and skillfully dressed stones are all pressed into the construction of the same uniform result without limits. The interior and the exterior of the same building can belong to completely different periods, but this does not prevent their aesthetic overlapping to the point of ultimate equating, like the superb collage in stone and brick around Byzantine wall paintings. Hellenistic tombstones can be incorporated into modern paving. Cornices and corbels from here and there can be interwoven in the benches of the sitting processes and in the protective surrounds of trees, all in the name of an aesthetic view of stratification which tends in the direction of the absolute identification of all the epochs. This is, of course, quite different from the situation in the archaeological site of the Agora. The excavations there were conducted by archaeologists on strictly academic criteria. Yet, the selective restoration of the Byzantine church and the debate over the architecture of the museum, which concluded in the emphatic reconstruction of the Hellenistic stoa, are facets of a primarily aesthetic approach to historical stratification. Here we have a case of a selection of clear and absolutely discrete styles, which can be juxtaposed without losing their cohesion and their disparity. As in every museum, the items are classified and all contribute to the specific narrative of history. On the level of historical stratification, the Agora Park has much in common with the park proposed by Kleanthis and Klenze. On the level of aesthetics, however, the vibrant expression of the picturesque has been replaced by arid exposition of the academic. That is why we have to visit the Agora with the guidebook in our hands and a ticket in our pockets. And that is also why no one has ever thought of writing a guidebook to the spaces landscaped by Pikionis or of charging an entrance fee to them. In modern times, coexistence of the old and the new is a fact of the life, and the allegories of the architectural heritage are part of the everyday experience of the Athenians. Yet, that experience is not simply a vehicle for objective reality. Historical stratification is a conscious choice and conveys the burden of an aesthetics, which, with an indubitable ideological background. The aesthetics of historical stratification was part of the established Western culture as far back as the 19th century, and in Greece, it found a natural field of application, which has produced examples as interesting as they are contrasting. In other words, the return of antiquity to modern Athens is not a simple ideological or more or less natural reappearance of the heritage of the past. It is bound up with the conditions of development of the great cities of the Western world, starting out from the socio-economic and cultural changes and extending to the rapid process of industrialization and urbanization of the 19th and 20th centuries. This paradox enables us to see the wish to idealize the ruins, a desire to regain the paradise, which is lost in the depths of modern reality. Its two complementary sides, the archaeological and the architectural, invoke the same terminally lost beginning. It is precisely this which explains the constant renewal of the proposals for the regeneration of the ancient and the continuity of the modern city. However, the only things which the past, which is irrecoverably lost, permits you to construct on its behalf are images founded on the dreams and ambitions of the modern collective unconscious. It is precisely for that reason that the reappearance of antiquity is not a return of the dead and all our beloved ancestors to the land of our day-to-day anxieties, but the projection of our culture, our aesthetics, and modern apprehension to a world about which we know very little. The archaeological trend is therefore no less architectural than the architectural trend. The archaeological sites in the center of Athens are much more than one can imagine the object of an architectural projection of the present, which is known to us on the practically blank surface of a past, which is to a large degree unknown. The park on the Hill of the Muses and the archaeological site of the Agora meet, but they do not conflict, because they have made real the difference in our visions of the state of affairs which we have chosen to narrate in rewriting the great fiction of antiquity. Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.